From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republican Congressman Dan Burton, chairman of the House investigation into Democratic fundraising practices, faced more questions today about his own campaign finance record. The Hill, a weekly newspaper on Capitol Hill, published a report that Burton had received money apparently raised by a tax-exempt religious organization. Such organizations are banned from funding political campaigns. NPR's Peter Overby has more.
The organization in question is a U.S. branch of the Sikh independence movement in the Indian state of Punjab. According to the Hill newspaper, the organization funneled contributions from Sikhs living in the United States to Burton, eight other members of Congress from both parties, and the Republican Party. Burton's lawyer said the congressman is reviewing some of the contributions and expects to return any that he shouldn't have accepted. Henry Waxman, top Democrat on Burton's investigative committee, said Democrats don't necessarily accuse Burton of wrongdoing.
But I know one thing. If that story came out and the people involved were President Bill Clinton or Vice President Al Gore, Congressman Dan Burton would have issued 50 subpoenas for more information.
Justice Department is investigating an allegation that Burton pressured a lobbyist for the Pakistani government for campaign money last spring. I'm Peter Overby in Washington.
At the Army sex trial at the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland, a 23-year-old enlisted woman testified she was raped 8 times and beaten by a drill sergeant. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
Calling him a devil with angel's wings, the Army specialist recalled a 3-month reign of terror in which Sergeant Delmar Simpson used his rank and his physical size to overwhelm the 5'2", 100-pound woman. As a trainee, she said, Simpson would directly order her to his office, which was equipped with a bed. There he would forcibly undress her and then rape her. The woman testified she didn't file charges against Simpson at first because she was afraid of him. It wasn't until she discovered that she had contracted chlamydia and then finally was beaten by Simpson for refusing an order that she told authorities. During her testimony, Simpson looked on passively, but if convicted, he could get life in jail. At the Aberdeen Proving Ground, I'm Philip Davis.
Attorney General Janet Reno added her support today to a proposed constitutional amendment designed to protect the rights of violent crime victims. Reno said victims' rights can best be protected by an amendment ensuring that victims can attend court and sentencing procedures. The amendment being considered by the Senate Judiciary Committee would allow victims to be present at court and parole hearings, to testify during sentencing, and to be notified about the release or escape of a defendant or prisoner. Supporters of the amendment say the Constitution makes no mention of victims' rights, although it guarantees the rights of the accused in 15 places. This is NPR. Opposition leaders in Israel are calling on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to step down following a police recommendation that he be indicted in an influence trading scandal. Radio reports say the Prime Minister has no plans to resign. Police made the recommendation following a 3-month investigation of charges that Netanyahu appointed an unqualified political crony as Attorney General in hopes of getting special treatment for a political ally who was charged with corruption. Most of the stock market rallied as the Dow Industrials moved higher for the third straight day. The average gained 92 points to 6,680, but the Nasdaq moved lower. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
Today's advance was led by tobacco stocks, which moved higher on optimism that talks between cigarette makers and industry opponents will produce a negotiated settlement to cover smoking-related health care costs. Philip Morris and RJR Nabisco gained 11 and 10% respectively. The market was also boosted by a list of unexpectedly strong earnings. Ford Motor, Merck, and Time Warner were among the companies reporting better than expected first quarter results. Gains in these shares helped the S&P 500 higher by nearly 9 points to 763. In the Nasdaq market, though, computer network issues moved lower on concern about increasing competition in that industry. The session's biggest loser was Clarify, Inc., whose shares plunged to a record low after the company warned of little or no revenue growth. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Commerce Department said today that builders laid foundations for fewer new houses and apartments in March. Housing starts fell by 6.4% last month, the biggest decline in 3 months. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Ray Suarez.
And I'm Robert Siegel.
It was confirmed today that tobacco industry officials have been meeting with state attorneys general over the past 3 weeks to see if there's a way to settle all legal issues confronting the industry. A settlement could put to rest all the legal claims against the tobacco companies, both from smokers who have been injured by cigarettes and by states which are suing to recover the costs of treating tobacco-related diseases. If a deal emerges from these negotiations, it would almost certainly require congressional action and White House approval, and it would have far-reaching implications both for the public health battle against tobacco and for the tobacco industry. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Attorneys general say they have been talking on and off with the tobacco companies for the past 6 months or so, but in the past 3 weeks, discussions with the two dominant companies, Philip Morris and RJR Nabisco, have taken off. Tobacco companies want to remain profitable in the face of mounting legal action against them, and Trey Bobbinger, assistant attorney general in Mississippi, says public officials want to curtail the nation's leading preventable cause of death and disease.
We want to make sure that our children are protected. That means restricting advertising. We also would like to see some regulation of the industry, perhaps with the Federal Food and Drug Administration having oversight, the payment of monies to states and to those who have been injured by tobacco as a product. Those are some issues that are being discussed and will be discussed.
The talks include not only attorneys general, but some public health experts and some plaintiffs' attorneys who are suing the tobacco industry on behalf of injured smokers. Part of the deal would involve a large fund for injured smokers that tobacco companies would have to create. In exchange, tobacco companies would be protected from product liability lawsuits. Today's Wall Street Journal reports that the size of that fund could be about $300 billion to be distributed over a period of 25 years. But John Cole, a spokesman for a group of about 100 plaintiffs' attorneys who are at the negotiating table, says money isn't the issue right now.
There's a lot to talk about. There's a lot of issues. And that's what we're doing.
The number $300 billion has been raised. Is that a number that has come up at the negotiating table?
No, we're not talking money now. We're talking health issues at this point.
So is that number not an accurate number?
That number is not an accurate number.
Even so, numbers in that range have been mentioned repeatedly by other sources familiar with the talks. The two tobacco companies involved in the talks referred all calls to a high-powered Washington, D.C. public relations firm they recently hired, and the firm declined to comment about any aspect of the reports. Participants caution that the negotiations are far from settled and could easily fall apart. And any deal would almost certainly have to involve congressional action, because part of the deal would involve a law granting the tobacco industry immunity from future lawsuits. And Congress doesn't like to be handed a done deal. Today on Capitol Hill, Senator Frank Lautenberg, a Democrat from New Jersey, said the tobacco companies should expect serious debate, not a rubber stamp.
You know, some might compare a deal with the tobacco company as a deal with the devil. But in this case, the devil, it's often said, is in the details, and it is particularly true here. We want to make sure that the conditions that we're concerned about will be included.
Those conditions would include much tougher federal control over the tobacco industry and reasonable compensation both for states and the victims of smoking-related diseases. Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, said the industry's willingness to negotiate is a sign that they are getting into trouble trying to defend themselves in court.
The tobacco companies are in a hurry to get out of the court, off the front pages of every newspaper, and back to the business of making billions of dollars in profit. Now, make no mistake about it. Regardless of the size of this settlement, the tobacco companies will see an increase in profits as a result of a settlement.
Indeed, tobacco stock prices rose sharply today on news of a possible settlement. But the tobacco industry will not only have to convince skeptics that the settlement price is fair, but that the tobacco restrictions that are part of the package would also be effective in reducing the toll of smoking-related death and disease in this country. Stanton Glantz, an anti-tobacco activist at the University of California in San Francisco, says the proposal as it stands fails miserably at that.
Any resolution of the litigation against the tobacco industry needs to basically transform the industry from its current malignant form into something which is not out there aggressively addicting new smokers and killing people. And this settlement wouldn't do it.
Glantz says he'd like to see the tobacco industry transformed into the equivalent of the methadone program for former heroin addicts. But anti-smoking negotiators seem to be aiming for more modest goals, aimed at preventing young people from taking up the habit rather than weaning those who are already addicted. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
RJR Nabisco held its annual shareholder meeting in Winston-Salem, North Carolina today. RJR is the parent company of RJ Reynolds, the nation's second-largest tobacco company. Michelle Johnson of member station WFDD in Winston-Salem has this report.
Dissident stockholders at RJR's annual meeting proposed 8 resolutions challenging management policy. They included retirement of the cartoon ad character Joe Camel and a spin-off of the company's R.J. Reynolds tobacco operation from its food business. All the resolutions failed as management brushed aside questions from anti-smoking activists. The company kept its officials away from reporters, and RJR refused comment that it and rival Philip Morris are involved in settlement talks with plaintiffs in up to 24 lawsuits. Reaction among stockholders to the report of a possible settlement was generally negative. Randy Bryant, who supports RJR management, called it a scam.
It's just a way of the government, the lobbyists for the government, to increase taxes. They don't care if people smoke or not. All they're wanting is more tax money. It's just a way of blackmailing the tobacco companies.
Stockholder Elizabeth Bowl said that the more pressure is placed on the cigarette industry, the more people will turn to illegal drugs. She wants the company to continue fighting lawsuits with states and individual plaintiffs.
I'm in favor of RJR winning them. Like I said, we've known for 30 years it was addictive and people still chose to smoke. And it's the person's fault. It's not the tobacco companies. They had a choice.
Anti-smoking activists were also wary of a settlement, but for different reasons. Ed Sweda is senior attorney for the Tobacco Control Resource Center, a tobacco industry watchdog.
Anything to actually be formulated into public policy has to have broad community support from the American public, including the public health community. And I think the proposal or any idea that would take away the right of people who come down with these diseases in the future to sue the tobacco companies would be totally unacceptable to the public health community.
Despite all the interest in a potential settlement, it was not on the agenda for today's meeting. In the end, RJR management and satisfied stockholders prevailed as they have in the past. For stockholder Elizabeth Bowl, there's a simple reason for her to hold on to RJR stock and hope for a few changes in the way the company operates.
It's profitable for the money. It's in my IRA. Pays a very good dividend.
RJR's chairman, Stephen Goldstone, told stockholders at the meeting that he wants to keep it that way. He said, quote, "We had a damn good year. When I get paid well, you get paid well." For National Public Radio, I'm Michelle Johnson in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
This year's 50th anniversary celebration of Jackie Robinson's integrating Major League Baseball has prompted much reminiscing, some soul-searching, and now at least one formal apology. It is from the town of Sanford, Florida, and it's for something that town did in 1946 during spring training. Larry Dale is the mayor of Sanford and joins us right now. Mayor Dale, first of all, what were the Brooklyn Dodgers doing in Sanford, Florida in 1946?
Well, a fellow named Branch Rickey was down in Sanford in 1946, and they had their pre-spring training camp here. And he had leased the municipal park for all-day play. 1946, so that's why he was here.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was not the season that Jackie Robinson entered Major League Baseball.
It was, no, well, he had been recruited by Branch Rickey to play for the Dodgers organization. Now, the organization included a lot of AAA International League play.
What happened when Jackie Robinson took the field in Sanford, Florida?
Jackie Robinson took the field, and of course, you know, we had a good many people watching baseball down here in those days. And somebody, and I don't even know who it was, is lost in history. I don't know, he's dead, objected to the fact that the black was playing baseball on a municipal field. And unfortunately, in 1946, like a lot of towns in the country at that time, we had a city ordinance that actually prohibited whites and blacks from competing together in any athletic or recreational activity on city-owned property. So this particular protester went to the police chief, Chief Williams at the time, and said, "I want the city ordinance enforced."
And did the chief enforce it?
The chief checked with City Hall, and he came down, and the chief and I think one of his police officers, they escorted Jackie off the field over to the first baseline dugout to comply with the ordinance. And then the chief immediately arranged for a conference over behind that dugout with Mr. Rickey, with the Dodgers organization, and this local protester. And they struck a compromise. And they agreed that Jackie Robinson could play a maximum of 3 innings of any game and then retire. The rest of the time, he could run and play pepper and do wind sprints or anything else they wanted him to do. So Jackie actually played his first Major League game on a white team here in Sanford, but unfortunately we did have a city ordinance that was enforced, at least to the extent that they allowed him to play 3 innings in the ball game.
And this, of course, was an exhibition game. This was not yet
this
the regular season.
This was a spring training exhibition day. They played the St. Paul Saints.
Mm. Now that the town of Sanford has, in fact, declared, it was yesterday, a day recognizing Jackie Robinson's accomplishment and also apologized for it. Have you communicated at all with Mrs. Robinson?
No, but we are. My secretary, Diane Cruz, has found her address. So I'm going to write Mrs. Robinson and send her a letter and a copy of the proclamation.
Do they play spring Grapefruit League baseball in Sanford anymore?
Not anymore. We are in the process of renovating our Sanford Memorial Stadium. We have an old stadium out there where Major League Ball was played, one of the remaining stadiums. Several of them have since been torn down, but we're in the process of renovating it and have been approached by the Orlando Sports Commission to bring back baseball. So there might be some glimmer there to revitalize that.
Well, Mayor Dale, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for calling.
Larry Dale is the mayor of Sanford, Florida.
The rights of crime victims, up next on NPR's All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered on 89.9 KCRW.
This Metro Traffic Report is made possible by Culligan Water Systems. We can cancel the traffic advisory in the San Fernando Valley for the Ventura Freeway. Westbound from White Oak to Reseda, the right lane along with the Reseda Boulevard off-ramp is now open. Caltrans has completed their work and traffic is recovering from Cahuenga Boulevard. In Anaheim, 57 southbound before Lincoln, we've got an accident blocking the carpool and the left lane. I'm Jonathan Chance on KCRW.
Books frequently entertain us, enlighten us, even transform us, but it's a rare pleasure when reader and author get to meet. I'm Ray Bradbury, and I invite you to join me and nearly 200 other authors for the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, April 19th and 20th at Dixon Plaza on the UCLA campus. There will be panel discussions, children's events, and exhibits from publishers and booksellers. Best of all, it's free. So come celebrate the written word at the Festival of Books.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Attorney General Janet Reno appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee today to testify in favor of a victim's rights amendment to the Constitution. The proposed amendment would give crime victims the right to attend and participate in trials and parole hearings. It would also assure that victims and their families are notified of the release or parole of the person convicted for the crime. In her testimony today, the Attorney General said she had worked under victims' rights laws at the local level when she was a prosecutor in Dade County, Florida, and she cited what she said was an imbalance in the court system between the rights of the accused and crime victims.
The administration supports an amendment that will bring balance to the criminal justice system. We are committed to continuing to work with Congress, with state and local prosecutors, federal and state judges, victim and victims groups, and others involved in the criminal justice system as we develop an amendment that gives real rights to victims and preserves the protections accorded to the accused.
Attorney General Janet Reno testifying today on Capitol Hill. Dan Richman is a visiting professor of law at the University of Virginia. He says the movement to guarantee a wide range of victims' rights in courts around the country has not yet changed the actual judicial process, but it may eventually.
When you send victims notification about when a courtroom proceeding will be held, you aren't affecting the proceeding. When you set up victim services programs that really try to help victims better cope with their losses, you're not affecting the adjudicatory proceeding. And even in those cases where we allow victims to get restitution ordered by the court or have impact statements considered at sentencing, we aren't changing the way we go about finding guilt or innocence. But we really are at a critical stage here. When you start having a legally recognized right on the part of victims to make sure a trial goes forward with due speed, when you let them have some sort of legally enforceable interest in being heard on plea bargaining matters, then you have taken a very large step towards making victims a party to the adjudication of guilt or innocence in a way that we never had before.
Well, you're a former prosecutor. Try to imagine standing up and having a rational, thoughtful, detailed conversation about where do we go from here with Fred Goldman, the Klass family, and the Kanka family, who all have specific interests that they want to pursue. I'm not sure that you can get to all the legal ins and outs because the weight of them as public personalities who have lived through terrible tragedy sort of trumps everything else.
Right, and 2 points follow from that. The one that follows directly is I wouldn't like to be the prosecutor to tell the murder victim's family, look, I think I need to cut an incredibly sweet deal with the murderer in order to prosecute other people in a related criminal organization. That would be a very hard conversation that I would be forced to have, I think, under many interpretations of what victims' rights amendments require. A second concern is related in a different way, which is that many of these conversations will be with exactly the kinds of people you've mentioned. Middle-class, represented victims who are very much able to spare the time and money to go after the person who hurt them or their loved one. There will be a great many victims who lack that money, who lack that time.
Does any of this muddy the waters for you? I mean, one of the foundational ideas about our legal system is that prosecution is done on behalf of us all against an accused person. Once we elevate the role of victims, we're making it more like civil court in that way where there is a personal grievance between one party and another.
Yes, I definitely think it does muddy the waters to the extent we let victims call the shots or even give them a legally cognizable right to be heard on calling the shots. We move a little away from the pure model of state punishment and more toward one of private vengeance.
Professor, thanks for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Dan Richman is a former assistant U.S. attorney and is currently a visiting professor at the University of Virginia Law School. We reached him at his office in Charlottesville.
Commentator David Cole says the call for a crime victims amendment misses the point of who the Constitution is meant to protect.
Who could be against crime victims' rights? You can't open the paper or turn on the television these days without being confronted by crime. The crimes are tragic, and our hearts go out to the victims. We all fear that one day we or our loved ones will be next. That's why victims' rights is such a popular political issue. But that's also why we do not need to amend the Constitution with a Victims' Rights Amendment. We need the Constitution to protect those who are unpopular, not those who already have the majority's support. We make certain principles of law constitutional because it is important that they be placed beyond the momentary impulses of the majority. The First Amendment, for example, protects speech because while we believe in the abstract that such protection is a good thing, we know that in particular cases we will be sorely tempted to suppress the speech that we hate. For the same reason, many of the provisions in the Bill of Rights protect those accused of crime. The Fourth Amendment prohibits blanket searches and seizures. The Fifth Amendment protects against compelled self-incrimination. The Sixth Amendment gives criminal defendants the right to a jury trial and a lawyer. And the Eighth Amendment bars cruel and unusual punishment. These are constitutional protections for the same reason that the First Amendment is. We believe in the principles in general, but we know that in particular instances, we will be tempted to bend the rules to punish those who we believe are guilty. The Constitution keeps us honest by denying the political majority its momentary desires in the interest of more long-term ideals. Unlike criminal defendants, victims do not need constitutional protections. Because they are by definition a sympathetic lot, their interests will be protected through the ordinary political process. More than 25 states have already passed victims' rights laws. Just last month, Congress passed a victims' rights law that overruled the judge in the Oklahoma City bombing trial, who had ruled that witnesses, including victims, could not attend trial until they had given their testimony. So crime victims' rights are an easy sell in legislatures across the country. But when was the last time you heard of a law being passed to protect criminal defendants' rights? Were it not for the Constitution, criminal defendants would have virtually no rights. There is no question that victims deserve our sympathy, and that prosecutors should be more respectful of their interests than they are now. But we don't need a constitutional amendment to guarantee that. It's human nature. We should save the Constitution for where it's truly needed.
David Cole is a professor at Georgetown University Law Center.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the company's annual meeting today, officials of RJR Nabisco offered no comment on a report the company is now in talks to settle health-related lawsuits. Paul Brown of member station WFDD reports from Winston-Salem.
This is the second year in a row that food and tobacco giant RJR Nabisco has held its annual shareholders meeting where its tobacco operations are based. But this year's meeting came on the same day the Wall Street Journal reported that RJR and its larger rival Philip Morris are in secret talks to settle dozens of health-related liability lawsuits. The settlement would reportedly ban future lawsuits. It would also include advertising restrictions and creation of a massive fund to pay health claims. The company itself refused comment on the Wall Street Journal report today, but dissident anti-smoking shareholders said that a settlement banning lawsuits would prevent citizens from holding RJR responsible for its actions in the future. Stockholders who support management said they don't want a deal because they want RJR to continue winning lawsuits and doing profitable business. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Brown in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Israeli officials are reportedly questioning Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tonight in connection with an alleged influence trading scandal. Israeli police are recommending the prime minister face charges following a three-month-long investigation into the ill-fated appointment of a little-known attorney general. Laurie Neff reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli police say they have recommended the prime minister be indicted for breach of trust and fraud following an investigation into the short-lived appointment of former Attorney General Rani Bar-On last January. The investigation was sparked by allegations government officials conspired to appoint Bar-On to win favorable treatment for a coalition partner facing corruption charges. Earlier reports said the police have also recommended charges against the political ally, Israel's justice minister, and a top Netanyahu aide. Police yesterday turned their findings over to the state attorney, who will decide whether or not to indict. An indictment would not force Netanyahu to resign, but it could prompt several of his coalition partners to abandon his government, leaving him with a minority in parliament or facing new elections. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Jerusalem.
Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says that good news is expected out of talks underway in New York City this week involving North and South Korea. U.S. officials hope that North Korea will agree to take part in upcoming Korean peace talks that will also include China. Yesterday, U.S. officials announced more food aid for North Korea, where there are extreme shortages after 2 years of flooding. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 93 points to close at 6,679.87 on volume of 499 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 7-5. This is NPR News. In Newfoundland, government officials have decided to let cod fishing resume on a limited basis. 4 years ago, the government banned cod fishing because of low supplies. This meant that 40,000 people were out of work and raised the nation's unemployment figure to nearly 20%. In the early 1980s, some 40,000 tons were cut off the southern coast and more than 100,000 tons in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. A top rebel leader from Zaire is now in South Africa for talks with South African President Nelson Mandela. Sean Crowley reports from Johannesburg.
Laurent Kabila, who now controls half of Zaire, flew into Cape Town to talk about peace. He met with senior South African government officials, including President Mandela. The confidential talks are the latest stage in South Africa's attempt to end the six-month civil war in Zaire. After the meeting at Mandela's official residence, government sources said that the talks had gone well and the discussions would continue on Thursday. No agreement on a ceasefire has been reached, and there are no details yet of predicted direct negotiations between the rebel leader and ailing Zairean president Mobutu Sese Seko. For National Public Radio, this is Sean Crowley in Johannesburg.
On Capitol Hill, some Democratic lawmakers in the House have proposed a mandatory $700,000 spending limit on campaigns for the House. More than 10 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that mandatory spending limits were in violation of rights to free speech. In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. Also in trading in Europe, gold prices were down. I'm Ann Taylor, NPR News in Washington.